Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Thursday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on February 1st, 2018. This is the week 4 class of our 2018 12-week Dhamma study based on my book, The Truth of Happiness. This class is on the wisdom factors of the Eightfold Path. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Peace.
We are, you're here at an auspicious time as well. We're in the middle of a 12-week study on one of my books, The Truth of Happiness. Do you know that book?
Yeah, I have that book.
Oh, okay.
I haven't read it, but I have it.
Oh. It works even better when you read it.
I started it.
This is the fourth week of study, the beginning of the Eightfold Path. That's why I say it's an auspicious time. Okay, so and the if you want to catch up, the audio and video recordings of all these classes are online.
Okay.
But again, a good time to come in. The Buddha awakened to dependent origination, which states from ignorance through 12 observable causative links, all manner of confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering arises. I know you've heard me say that about 100 times, or maybe 1,000 times, but that's what it is. And it's a very specific ignorance. It's ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And those truths are, number one, dukkha occurs. Dukkha is a Pali word that means minor disappointment and a general unsatisfactory experience with life, all the way to extreme emotional and physical suffering. Dukkha means suffering or stress in general, and a general unsatisfactory experience in life due to three marks of existence: the impermanence of all things, a misunderstanding of what constitutes a self, or the word that the Buddha used was anatta, and the resulting suffering from misunderstanding those first two things. First noble truth, dukkha occurs. The second noble truth is that craving originates and clinging perpetuates suffering, dukkha. And it's in all that, the craving and clinging relates to ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Because we don't understand the true nature of ourselves in relation to the world, we create assumptions or wrong views. And once we establish those wrong views, we tend to cling to those views. And we establish wrong views because we crave for the establishment of this thing called a self in a permanent way. And that's not possible in an impermanent environment. The third noble truth, that cessation of that process rooted in ignorance, is possible. And that points directly to impermanence. And in a general way, the Four Noble Truths are a teaching on impermanence. The fourth noble truth is that the Eightfold Path is the path leading to the understanding of suffering and the cessation of suffering. This is a quote from the book, and this is from the Samyutta Nikaya 56.11, if you're interested. The words of the Buddha, and notice how these words relate directly to what I just said, or the Four Noble Truths. Let me just preface this a little bit more. We're talking about right view and right intention tonight. Right view initially is the view that I don't know everything. It's an acceptance that there's something missing. Life seems a little bit unsatisfactory. I don't quite understand what's going on. I don't quite understand the nature of my own disappointment. Or it might be just a general feeling of unease or dis-ease. And we start looking for answers. Why do I feel this way? It might be that I have everything going for me. In a way, the Buddha was born a prince, and his father's kingdom had everything that anybody could ever want. And his father went overboard in lavishing everything on his young son, and all of that left young Siddhartha disappointed. He couldn't understand, why do I have all these things, and I have no real enjoyment of my own life. What's missing? And he left the palace grounds for the first time at the age of 29. I should say the first time unattended. Every time he had left earlier, it was always orchestrated for him to see just everything is just perfect in the world. And so when he snuck out under the cover of darkness and walked through a town for the first time in his life, he saw sickness, aging, and death. He saw the competitiveness and the aggressiveness of the people in the town. One of the things that so shocked him was he saw a dead body on the side of the road, but he couldn't understand that because he never saw that. And he asked his attendant, Chanda, who was with him, he says, why is that man sleeping on the side of the road? Doesn't he have a home? He says, he's not sleeping, he's dead. And the Buddha said, what do you mean? Siddhartha at that point, what do you mean he's dead? He didn't even have a context for understanding death. And he says, well, Chanda says, well, we all end up that way. And that, along with his other experiences at that point, so shocked young Siddhartha, he was 29 at the time, that he decided that he has to leave the palace grounds and seek understanding. If every one of us is going to end up like that man on the side of the road, what is the point? Why do we spend so much time in competitiveness and acquisition? Why do we spend so much time in conflict with each other if we all end up like that? What's the point? So he set out looking for that. Initial right view is that view that there's something missing. There's something that we'd like to understand that we don't quite have yet. That's the opening. That's the beginning of developing profound right view. The profound right view the Buddha described as understanding the nature of suffering. Makes sense, isn't it? Because the Buddha described the problem as dukkha and a misunderstanding of that. So awakening, as far as the Buddha is concerned, is developing a profound and penetrative understanding of the nature of suffering in the world and our own contributions to our own stress and suffering. So the Buddha's words on that, and this is in the book. And what is right view? Knowledge with regard to stress. Pretty simple and direct, isn't it? And it really is that simple and direct. The problem is that we have minds that are conditioned in ignorance, and that's what we are here to overcome. That's what the Buddha taught. The reason why he taught an eightfold path is to overcome that conditioned thinking. A modern word for that is confirmation bias, which means that we're biased towards seeing things in a way that confirms the view that we're holding rather than what's actually occurring. That's that clinging nature of ignorance. Is that clear? Because that's such a key point. And so when we can understand that, then we can start investigating our own ignorance, can't we? Because now we've kind of given ourselves permission to look at it. Whereas before, when we don't have the context in which to engage in that inquiry into our own ignorance, we won't do it. In fact, we wouldn't even think of it. Because it's the nature of ignorance to ignore anything that would challenge its own ignorance. That is the overall distraction of the world and most of the things that we engage in. The Buddha could have nearly as accurately stated the first noble truth as there is distraction, because it is the constant preoccupation with dukkha, with getting what makes us feel happy, what satisfies us, which is ultimately impossible, and avoiding anything that might take away from our own satisfaction, that we spend our whole lives chasing that. And that chase or craving originates in ignorance. So no matter what we acquire, we could acquire the wealth of a Buddha, or the Buddha when he was in his father's kingdom, and it won't satisfy us. There's nothing in the phenomenal world that can bring ultimate satisfaction. The only thing that can bring that is understanding the nature of suffering, which really is understanding the nature of the world. Because when the Buddha says dukkha occurs, he's really saying as a consequence of having a human life, you are going to have an unsatisfactory experience. And that doesn't mean every single experience is going to be disappointing or unsatisfactory. That's foolish. We've all had wonderful experiences in our lives. We've had wonderful days, maybe a run of great days, one after another. But ultimately that ends, doesn't it? Something occurs that takes away from that and makes us start feeling like, I'm not happy. I need to get back to being happy. And that sets that conditioned thinking in motion again and takes us outside of our own peace and calm mind and has our focus now external, what I need to continue to maintain happiness. That's clear, isn't it? Go back to what I just said. And what is right view? Knowledge with regard to stress or dukkha. Knowledge with regard to the origination of stress. Knowledge with regard to the second noble truth, where it comes from. Knowledge with regard to the cessation of stress relates directly to the third noble truth. We have experience. Knowledge with regard to the cessation of stress, having that knowledge, means we've had the experience of, even if it's just momentarily, we're not talking about profound awakening here, just momentarily we've had the experience of the cessation of stress within our own minds. And it's for most of us, this usually occurs during a meditation practice. Knowledge with regard to the path or practice that develops the cessation of stress. This is called right view, again, pointing directly to the Eightfold Path. With a lot of the Buddhist teachings, you can take a paragraph like this out and say, The entire Dhamma is included in that paragraph. And that's true about this one. Everything the Buddha taught or would teach is reflected in this single paragraph. Excuse me. The Buddha continues, this is a little bit later on in the sutta, the Buddha refers to right view as the forerunner of developing the Dhamma. So what he's pointing out is that right view is both the entry point into developing the Dhamma, which simply means accepting that I don't know everything. And that's a hard thing for a self-referential ego personality to accept. I know for my entire life, until I came to what the Buddha actually taught, I really did know everything there was to know. At least I thought I did. And it created great stress in my life over and over again. I was the type of person that if I got into a discussion with someone, even though I believed their point of view, because I had to establish who I was, I would argue to the death my point of view, even though I knew it was foolish. I did that. And we create incredible conflict in our lives by simply trying to maintain this thing which can't be maintained and this thing that is rooted in ignorance. The great peace that comes from developing the Dhamma is accepting the fact that I don't need to know anything except how to take control of my mind. Because all the other things that I might want to hold on to are impermanent in nature and ultimately, as using the Buddha's words, they're like foam on the ocean. There's no substance to it. So why should I even care about it? Why should I engage in constant conflict in my own mind over things that have no meaning at all, no true lasting meaning? What is most important, what the Buddha discovered, is that the most significant thing is to understand the nature of self as being in a constant process of becoming. And that leads directly to what I will become is what I hold in mind, which is the ultimate type of mindfulness. Mindfulness means to recollect or to hold in mind. And the path, the Eightfold Path, is a path that uses the Eightfold Path, each factor of the Eightfold Path, to train our minds to appropriate mindfulness, to understand what is most important to hold in mind, to develop this ongoing right view that is never challenged by what's occurring. A mind that completely understands the nature of stress. The Buddha says, and how is right view the forerunner? It leads directly to what we're doing here, and leads directly to the Dhamma. One discerns wrong view as wrong view. How much simpler could the Dhamma be? We understand wrong view is wrong view. But how can we do that? It's the nature of a deluded mind. Let me say that another way. How would a mind that is deluded understand that it's deluded if it has no reference for understanding that? Everything that a deluded mind would see is seen from that viewpoint of delusion. And it fits confirmation bias. It's biased towards confirming its own delusion, no matter how much suffering follows from that. That's what the Buddha awakened to, and that's why he developed an Eightfold Path as the framework for recognizing our own confirmation bias, our own deluded thinking. And that's why it's called the forerunner. It's simply the acceptance that I don't know everything. And at some point, to realize that all of the thought constructs, the mental fabrications, the assumptions that I've made about myself in relation to the world are rooted in ignorance, and so have no validity at all in establishing who I am in a peaceful and calm way. I have to let go of the views. That's what, when the Buddha used the term anatta to mean the not-self-characteristic, that's what he said. Anatta was a term that was common during his time, but the Buddha used it in a completely different way. He used it to remind ourselves that the views you're holding to describe a self are wrong views. Let go of the views. And he's referring to that here. One discerns wrong view is wrong view. We understand it. And we also understand right view is right view. And we understand that at a very profound and penetrative level, ultimately, as an awakened human being, we understand right view as right view. We can see it. Why? How can we see it? How can we be sure? Because we have the experience of it. We don't take anything that the Buddha taught, teaches on faith. He continually said, ehepasiko, coming see for yourself, meaning that this is not something you should believe in. It's something that you have to experience. And we experience it through developing the Eightfold Path. Let me go back just at one line. One discerns wrong view as wrong view, and right view as right view. This is one's right view. in a few sentences. Again, the Buddha describes the entire Dhamma, or at least the entire development of the Dhamma, where it takes us. Now remember, a mind that is completely settled in right view is always at peace, always calm, and always skillfully engaged with the world. It's a non-reactive mind. It's a very powerful mind, by the way. Because it's not controlled by anything outside of its own understanding. Buddha continues. And what is wrong view? Now he's describing what happens when we're stuck in wrong view. And ultimately what I'm going to say refers to not giving up any self-referential thought, view, or idea. Not giving up any of the eye-making that we've done to ourselves. Not giving up a shred of ignorance. And if we think that's all we are, we can't let it go. If I think that my wrong views of self constitute who I am, I'm not going to let go of any of it, am I? Because it's me. It feels like death if I try to do that. The Buddha says, and what is wrong view? There is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed. There is no fruit or result of good or bad actions. He's referring to karma there. Nothing sacrificed, meaning it means that I'm holding on to every shred of my own ignorance. I'm not willing to let go of any of it. No matter how much suffering I bring into my own life as a result of my views and my beliefs and my needs and desires and my compulsions and my addictions that all follow from that, no matter how much suffering they bring into my life or that I notice it's bringing into the world at large, I can't let go of any of it. I'm not willing to let go of anything. That's wrong view. Rather than a mind that is not stuck in conditioned thinking, confirmation, bias, delusion, would have an experience that was painful and immediately stop doing that. But nobody does that. We continue to do the same things and engage, and I'm not talking about just people that are addicted to substances. That's a very good example of it. People stuck in compulsion and addiction. But everybody does that. Everybody continues acting from that conditioned, deluded view, no matter what the consequences are, because we've decided that's who we are. There is no fruit or result of good or bad actions. There is no this world, no next world, no mother, no father, no spontaneously reborn beings. So that sounds like we're getting a little bit into creationism and maybe a little bit of mythology. But all that the Buddha is talking about is what we're giving birth to in this moment. There's no this world, no next world. This world is this moment. The next world is the next moment. If my mind is continually rooted in ignorance, this moment is rooted in ignorance, and the next moment, the next world has to be rooted in ignorance because I've done nothing to change that thinking. Is that clear? The reference to no mother, no father means that we're not taking our own responsibility for what's occurring, what we're creating, what we're giving birth to in this moment. There's no mother and no father. The Buddha the way you have to understand that too is to understand the Buddha didn't teach anything mystical. He didn't use allegory except in a very direct and obvious way. So when he's talking about mother and father and et cetera, this world, that world, he's talking about what's occurring right now. What does a mother and father do? A mother and father gives birth. What do? We are our mothers and fathers rooted in ignorance, giving birth to another ignorant moment. Or we are our mother and father with our minds well-framed, holding right view, giving birth to a moment that will lead to continual peace and freedom. Clear? Okay. No spontaneously reborn beings is really the same thing. A spontaneously reborn being is me holding on to ignorance and spontaneously giving birth, being reborn as a continued ignorant person. And the reason why that is significant, and the Buddha is even speaking of it, is you have to remember the context the Buddha's teaching. He's teaching people that already have a relatively well-developed grasp of the Dhamma and understand even the physical nature a moment by moment giving birth to a new moment. And so it took us 2,600 years to realize that every moment there's millions of cells that come into existence and go out of existence. That's just part of having a healthy human life, right? And even over the course of about 7 years, every single cell in our body is replaced by new cells. So you could say that each and every moment, even though it seems like I'm just the same as I was a moment ago, the truth is I'm not. Even on a physical level, I'm physically different. And our minds can work that same way if we don't hold on to wrong views. Our minds can be so brilliant and present that each thought is a new thought. An awakened human being experiences life that way. Everything is fresh. There's nothing, we're not dragging any baggage. There's no confirmation bias. There's no conditioned thinking in this moment because I haven't attached myself to it. It's remarkable, isn't it? Yes, Nick?
That's, I just want to like point out one for my own, like remembering that that's a really like powerful statement and really like something like that hasn't occurred to me. You've said it, but just the way that you explained it, how everything's fresh because you're not bringing any expectations or confirmation bias to every moment.
Yes.
That everything is brand new.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to affirm.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that. It's the essence of an awakened mind. You have to think about that. When the Buddha talks about a pure mind, it's in that way, that mind is, there's nothing, another word that's often used is defilements. There's nothing defiling the mind in this moment to alter the experience of what's occurring. And think about the profundity of that statement. Then no matter what's occurring, no matter how upsetting it might have been in the past, because we are completely present with what's occurring, without any self-referential view that this thing needs to be any different than it is, it's simply an occurrence. It doesn't mean that awful things are seen as wonderful. They're simply seen as what's occurring in this moment, and we understand the impermanent nature of it. And what's most important, like the Buddha says in the Vatthakasanthana Sutta, we gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it. In that moment, we are simply accepting of what's occurring. Our minds are fresh. Each and every moment that's occurring, because we don't cling to anything. We're not developing a mind that is stuck in views. We're developing a mind that is completely mindful of what's occurring.
You know, it makes me think that people who live that way have a much better memory of their life because of living in the moment.
Judy, you touched on something that I wasn't even going to talk about, but it's so profound. The Buddha occasionally, I'm not even sure if I can explain this. I don't want to get too deep into this, so I'll just kind of say it. One of the things that was established and later developed in the Mahayana schools was how to tell you're awakened, and one of them was you have direct knowledge of past lives. The Buddha mentioned that, but not in the way of describing awakening. The only time he described awakening was in this way, in understanding right view. But when you've let go of all clinging to wrong views, then every moment is a new lifetime. You're not carrying any view of who you were in the previous moment. And in that way, you have direct memory of, or a very profound memory of everything that's occurring, because your mind isn't clouded by clinging attachments to views. You're simply engaged in the continuum of life. And again, then each and every moment, the whole point of independent origination between the sixth and the seventh condition, the Buddha talks about becoming. And if our minds are rooted in ignorance, this is why the name of the book is called Becoming Buddha, by the way. If our minds are rooted in ignorance, we can only become further ignorant in this moment. But if our minds are well framed by the Eightfold Path, then we're giving ourselves the ability to become awakened. That's what it means. That's the message of dependent origination. What are we going to become? Do we want to become a mind further stuck in craving and clinging for experience and sensory fulfillment? Or do I want to become free of all that? Do I want to shed this thing that is prone, to confusion, delusion, and thinking, meaning a self rooted in wrong views? I do. And the most remarkable thing, and I, whenever I talk about this, I think about, and I remember clearly a time many years ago when it hit me that this is the way to do that. That this is a path to true freedom and liberation. From what? Not from the world. From my own wrong views. But I didn't even understand that until I got to that point. Up until that point, I was taught that this is that awakening is mostly dependent on gaining favor from external beings or doing enough rituals or chanting enough or doing enough of this and that. And eventually awakening will be bestowed on me. The Buddha never taught anything like that. He said, change the way you think and you'll change your experience of who you are. All rooted in wrong view. Beginning and ending in right view, I mean. The Buddha continues. Let me go back one line. No spontaneously reborn beings. No Brahmins or contemplatives. Now, Brahmins is a word that has a lot of different meanings during the Buddha's time. What he's referring to now is just people that are developing the Dhamma. No Brahmins or contemplatives who faring rightly and practicing rightly. Again, the Buddha's putting an emphasis on there's one way to do this, there's a right way, and then there's all the other ways. It don't lead to anything. It just leads to more confusion. Practicing rightly, proclaim this world and the next, having directly known and realized it for themselves. Proclaiming this moment and the next moment as an opportunity to become awakened. The Buddha continues, there is no fruit or result of good, just a comment on that line, there is no fruit or result of good or bad actions, mean that there is no understanding of the consequences of our own actions. We continue our ignorance. When we understand the fruit of our actions, the karma that we create, truly understand it in the right framework, we'll simply recognize our own ignorance and abandon it. There's no analysis, there's no long process, there's no intervention from gods or deities. There's nothing except our own understanding. Let me just go a little bit further. The Buddha describes, and we're going to get into right effort and right mindfulness in 2 weeks, but this is how right view and right intention relates to right effort. One tries to abandon wrong view and enter and remain in right view. And this is, he also describes right mindfulness this way. We hold in mind right view, and maintain mindfulness of right view. One tries to abandon wrong view and enter and remain in right view. This is one's right effort. One is mindful to abandon wrong view and to enter and remain in right view. This is one's right mindfulness. Thus, these three qualities, right view, right effort, and right mindfulness, run in circle around right view. In other words, they're all part of right view. In fact, you could say that a fully developed eightfold path can be described as an overarching right view. But all eight factors are necessary, required to develop that. Now remember how this talk began. And what is right view? Knowledge with regard to stress, knowledge with regard to the origination of stress, knowledge with regard to the cessation of stress, and knowledge with regard to the path or practice that develops the cessation of stress. This is called right view. I realize that's how I started, that's how I wanted to end this talk on right view, just to emphasize that. It all is taught and understood in the context of Four Noble Truths. Right intention, the second factor that we're considering tonight, the second factor of the Eightfold Path, relates directly to the Second Noble Truth. Craving originates and clinging perpetuates suffering. Then right intention is maintaining the intention or maintaining the mindfulness of recognizing and abandoning craving and clinging as it arises. It's not something that we can project into the future. We can develop the mindfulness in the present. But in application, as we find that we're recognizing something that is rooted in ignorance, rooted in eye-making, holding in mind the intention to recognize that in the moment is the secret, it really is no secret, of developing the Dhamma. And it becomes a very practical moment-by-moment application of being mindful of our own minds and taking care of our own minds, not going to reaction, not going to distraction, gaining the ability to recognize, especially as far as the Dhamma is concerned, what's the true Dhamma and what is just an embellishment or an accommodation that leads to just more distraction. And I'm referring to the later developments of Buddhism after the Buddha passed. And this was common even during the Buddha's time. There were people that wanted to take what the Buddha, because he was building a reputation now, someone who knew what he had. So people would come in, they'd learn a little bit about the Dhamma, they'd go out and they'd make it their own, and they'd add things to it, usually something that was attached to the Vedas, the precursor to modern Hinduism. And they still do that today. There's a modern movement called Advaita, A-D-V-A-I-T-A, which is simply a hybridization of the Vedas of Hinduism. And most people that study that, and some very famous teachers, insist that that's something the Buddha taught, when it's actually something the Buddha looked at and rejected. The Eightfold Path is the path that brings liberation and freedom, and it's the only path. And it's the simple path, and it's a direct path, and it's a path that anybody can integrate into their lives. Some people take a little bit more time. Some people struggle with it a little bit more to let go of wrong views, but that's unimportant. The Buddha also said that if you do this, remember how many of you remember the teachings on the Satipatthana and the Anapanasati Sutta, the four foundations of mindfulness and breath awareness suttas? Both of those suttas, the Buddha concludes with a promise that if you develop this perfectly, and perfectly is not unattainable for anyone, if you develop this perfectly, in 7 years you're awakened. In fact, he goes on to say, you might do it in 7 weeks, or 7 months, or 7 days, or 7 hours, or 7 minutes, if you do it perfectly. That's the end of today's talk. Thank you. Then any questions before then we'll go around the room. So before we go around the room, I've got one more thing to say. In the Ratana Sutta, the Buddha talks about the three refuges of the Buddha, meaning an understanding that an awakened human being actually did that. He awakened. Taking refuge in the Dhamma, that this awakened human being left his teaching, and take refuge in a well-focused Sangha. And the Buddha talked about the importance of a well-focused Sangha, meaning it's not something that gets into everything, every thought that's out there, every practice, every modern speaker, you know. It stays focused on the Dhamma. And what we have here, what's developed here in Frenchtown, is a true refuge. And that's reflected in our meditation practice, too. Our meditation practice should be viewed from that point of view, that when we sit on our cushion, that is a true refuge from the world. And in that refuge, in that deepening concentration, developing the refined mindfulness that can hold in mind all eight factors of the Eightfold Path, then our ongoing life, our moment-by-moment life, becomes a true refuge from the world around us. So again, just something I was thinking about today and I wanted to add it. Nash, it's good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you for asking.
I was actually going to mention the taking refuge. I hadn't realized, I've been gone for a while, I hadn't realized until I sat down and we started meditating again that I just like had this feeling of, I can't really describe it, but it's like a positive, like a feeling of like safety, comfort. Yeah. And then when you started reading the sutta, like of joy, that is very familiar, like in being here.
Yeah.
So it was, I don't know, I didn't even like realize that it was something that I was, like that I wasn't experiencing. Because I'm satisfied with how my Dhamma practice is progressing, but it's just a whole different thing to be like in this room and to go over the suttas in that way. I'm very grateful that I have this to come back to.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that. I am too. You know, I am so grateful for what's developed here and to have the Dhamma. It's, to me, it's the most auspicious thing that's ever happened to me in this life. Most important thing, and I say it so often, we're so fortunate, and it's not, you know, it sounds maybe self-aggrandizing, but I don't mean it that way. I'd be pretty foolish sitting here every Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday by myself. It's because of you folks that have formed the Sangha. Sangha is not just one person, it's everybody, and it really is remarkable what's developed here. I haven't seen it anywhere else in any of the Buddhist institutions that I've been a part of. I have something that's well focused on just what the Buddha taught. We're fortunate. Good to see you tonight. Isabel, good to see you.
Good to see you.
Hmm.
Ah. very grateful for the Dhamma.
Well said. It sounds like a gratitude evening. So I'm grateful that you're here tonight too. Judy, good to see you.
Hi there.
How are you?
I'm fine.
Good.
I think his name is Nash. I realized I was missing this as well. I was trying to figure out, because I started doing something else on Tuesdays for my health, joined Weight Watchers, and I kept saying, well, you know, my family still depends on me to do this and this and this, and I'm trying to spend less on takeout. And you know, my husband's like, you're never around. And I said, you know what? Bleep it. I want to go. I like it. And it will help me with the clinging and craving of the chocolate.
Yeah, it will. So, in a very practical way.
Yeah. And so, or food in general. I want to change that whole relationship to food. And I realized I had this tool that I wasn't using, and so I wanted to come back and start using it again. Mm-hmm. And we are trying to figure out, we're both kind of sick of the rat race, and my husband really just wants to move to Utah and spend his day in the Colorado Plateau and just hike and exist out there. But we still have familial obligations, so we're trying to figure out very much how to get rid of the stuff, but still have place for our two grown sons who still live with us, going to school and stuff.
Yeah.
And that's proving to be a little difficult, but we're not bringing in the income that we were. And so... for them to be close to where they go to school, we can't be real far. Otherwise, we would just move into Pennsylvania or something,
yeah,
where it's a little less expensive. So we are trying to get... We just wanted... We just don't want it anymore. We enjoyed it for a while. But... so there's this stress that he would be very happy with almost nothing in the desert. You know, he could live in a little, almost a shack, and he'd be perfectly fine. But around here, he doesn't want to let it go because he doesn't have the desert. And he wants a comfortable house if he can't be in the desert. So we're struggling with the, what do we need, or what can we live with at a lower level.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't quite come to an agreement on that.
Well, it's certainly an exercise in impermanence, isn't it? You know?
Yeah.
I think you'll see as you continue to develop the Eightfold Path, some of those decisions aren't even decisions anymore. Things like that just kind of fall away. You know, our lives naturally become simpler on the inside, and not necessarily reflected on the outside. We might still live in the big house, but our minds are quiet and at peace now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad you're here tonight.
Thank you. I'm glad you're still here. I wasn't sure. I didn't check the email.
Yeah. No, I'm still here.
You're still doing Thursdays.
Yeah, Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. So. Kevin, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Thank you. Thank you for sharing your wisdom about the wisdom factors. I was just thinking when Judy was talking, it sounds like her husband needs to find the Dhamma.
He's pretty much a Buddhist. Could, like I said, if he could just go out to Utah, he wouldn't need much of anything. Nash before said something about expectations. My husband said expectation only leads to disappointment. He's been telling me this for 30 years. And so he's always in the present. He's quite calm. It's just that now we have this conflict. We've always lived one way where one or both of us have made enough money to support the lifestyle to which we have become accustomed. And now we no longer do that. So now what do we do?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and so it's now we have to actually do something about that. And so that's...
You know, this the
path and the Dhamma is laid out so clearly in this. And it's, as you say, it's simple, but it's not for the faint of heart. You know, it's just in meditating, even in meditating, to relinquish clinging and craving is so difficult because the anatta, the not-self, is ever-present and ever-distracting. Yeah. And, you know, with worry about life and with love of others, and but then it's really all manifestations of clinging and craving. Yeah. And at times when it seems like that dissipates, it seems like a really, you know, joyful experience. Yeah. Last week I was, you know, I was gloating about how I had spent a really auspicious week with, you know, really intense meditation and chewing beautifully. And then this week it seemed like more distraction, just anatta, just, you know, yourself, just, you know, with just distractions and hindrances that come up. But it's intention. I think it's really the right intention, too. And it's interesting how it's put that way. It doesn't demand necessarily perfection immediately, but it's the intention, and it climbs toward that perfection.
Yeah.
We'll get there.
Well, that's profound in saying it that way, Kevin, that right intention is almost a cover for or points to that we're not going to do it perfectly, but the intention to develop the Dhamma, as the Buddha said, to do that perfectly is what's important. Yeah. Along the way, we understand that there's going to be impermanence in even our meditation practice and our experience of it. And you, again, you referred to recognizing that as distraction, as hindrances. And what do? You come back to the sensation of breathing. That's a very practical and profound development in understanding the Dhamma. Ultimately, it's a profound understanding of the impermanence of all things. And when we really understand the impermanence of all things, nothing bothers us. There's nothing to cling to, because why would you cling to anything that it's impermanent? And all things are impermanent. We live in that type of an environment. That's the insight. Shamatha means tranquil mind, vipassana means insight. That's the insight that we gain in the Dhamma. It's very specific to those three marks of existence: impermanence, not self, and dukkha. And that's just what you described, Kevin. So thank you very much. Any other questions about the wisdom factors of the Eightfold Path? So we'll study the next chapter, which is on the virtuous factors. I'll give a little talk on that next week, and we'll discuss that, and we'll continue with our Truth of Happiness Dhamma study. I think that's all. We'll finish with metta, as we always do. So find your relaxed meditative posture, and gently close your eyes, and gently close your mouths. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing, your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbound, free from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, Free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you for a wonderful class. Thank you, folks that joined online. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.